Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Dan Friedel tells us about a possible ban on bullfighting in France. Katie Weaver and I present this week's Health and Lifestyle Report. We close the show with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Dan Friedel.
Supporters and opponents of bullfighting recently marched on the streets of several cities in southern France. Earlier this month, an opinion study said about 75% of the French public want to ban bullfighting, but a small group of supporters say it is a tradition that should continue. Baptiste is a 16-year-old boy training to be a bullfighter in southern France. He lives in Arles, a town close to the Mediterranean Sea. Baptiste says the people who want to ban bullfighting do not understand corrida, another name for bullfighting. Corrida is a tradition, an art, a dance with the bull, Baptiste said. He is one of about 12 students in Arles learning how to fight bulls. The people in France who do not like bullfighting wonder how it can be called an art when an innocent animal is killed at the end. During a recent protest march, one sign read, "Corrida is not a fight. It's the execution of a tortured innocent." Aymeric Caron is a French lawmaker who sent a bill to Parliament that would ban bullfighting. It is currently being debated. He said, some parts of France permit bullfighting as long as fewer than 1,000 bulls are killed each year. Just because it is a tradition, he said, does not morally justify a practice. Other lawmakers in Caron's party are not supporting his bill, so it is not likely to pass. But the news of the anti-bullfighting proposal started a discussion in France. Frédéric Pastore oversees the bullfights in the city of Nîmes. He said the bull is glorified during the fight, although it is killed. Nîmes is home to 14 bullfighting shows each year. They bring in over $60 million to the city, which is just northwest of Arles. Tiffany Saint-Martin-Laurent is one of the protesters. She said, most people are against bullfighting. Torture is not a show, she said. Spain is considered the place where bullfighting began. People there are also questioning the practice. Bullfighting was banned in the Spanish province of Catalonia in 2010, but later brought back. A major court in Spain called the practice a cultural asset. That means it is considered a tradition that has value. A new proposal on animal safety in Spain does not discuss bulls. I'm Dan Friedel.
It has been 5 months since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. The ruling ended a 50-year-old legal right to abortion nationwide. Instead, individual states now decide on whether to permit, limit, or ban the medical procedure to end a pregnancy. Some doctors in states with restrictive abortion laws say they have sent more patients to go somewhere else than ever before. Some women say they are facing harmful, possibly deadly, delays. Doctors say they are forced to balance medical judgment with possible punishments, including prison time.
Weeks after the overturn of Roe, Dr. Grace Ferguson treated a woman whose water had broken halfway through pregnancy. The baby would never survive, and the patient's chance of developing a possibly life-threatening infection grew with every hour. The woman had already spent 2 days at a hospital in West Virginia before she saw Ferguson in the neighboring state of Pennsylvania. She was not able to get an abortion in West Virginia because the state bans the procedure except in the case of a medical emergency. The patient's life was not in danger at that exact time, so doctors did not operate. At the hospital in Pennsylvania, where abortion is legal, Ferguson was able to induce labor to end the pregnancy.
Although even the strictest laws permit abortion to save a mother's life, a serious question remains. How close to death must the patient be? You don't automatically go from living to dead, Ferguson said. You slowly get sicker and sicker. It is impossible to say when that line is crossed, said Dr. Allison Haddock. She is on the board of the American College of Emergency Physicians. There's just no moment where I'm standing in front of a critically ill patient where I know, okay, before their health was just in danger, but now their life is in danger, she said. Experts say it is hard to know the number of abortion denials when serious complications happen. Employers often tell their healthcare workers not to speak about such cases. Even still, the Associated Press reached several doctors and patients who shared stories of such denials.
Many doctors and researchers agree that evidence shows it is a widespread problem. In Texas, for example, a doctor's association sent a letter to the state's medical board saying some hospitals refused to treat patients with major complications because of the state's abortion ban. Dr. Kara Heuser is a maternal fetal specialist in Utah. She recalled one patient who was denied an abortion in the neighboring state of Idaho despite developing a serious heart condition halfway through pregnancy. The woman had to be sent to Utah for the procedure. Dr. Lauren Miller is a maternal fetal specialist in Idaho's capital of Boise. She said she often sees patients whose water breaks at 15 through 19 weeks of pregnancy. All that doctors can do is help them make the difficult decision. Do they stay here for their care and just wait until something bad happens, or do we facilitate them finding care out of state? The stories are similar when pregnancy is complicated by cancer. About 1 in 1,000 pregnant women find out they have cancer each year. Dr. Karen Knudsen is Chief Executive Officer of the American Cancer Society. She said some cancer doctors have questions about treating pregnant cancer patients, especially when therapies may cause miscarriage.
Some abortion opponents say doctors may be unnecessarily denying abortions in life-threatening situations out of fear. Dr. Patty Giebink is a former abortion doctor who described changing her opinion about the procedure in her book, Unexpected Choice, An Abortion Doctor's Journey to Pro-Life. She said it comes down to intent. If you intend to save the mother and not end the life of the fetus, she said, you are doing good medicine. We are sort of in a period of time where all these questions come up, she said. The legislatures are going to be working to solve some of these problems. Dr. Paul LaRose is a member of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. He said he thinks the issue is overstated. Most pro-life physicians would take care of the mother and do what's necessary without purposely taking the life of the unborn baby, LaRose said. But some women say restrictive abortion laws have put them in danger.
Melissa Farmer is from Joplin, Missouri. In August, her water broke 17 and a half weeks into her pregnancy. She went to the emergency room. Tests showed she had lost all her amniotic fluid. The fetus she and her boyfriend had named Maeve was not expected to survive. Despite risks of infection and blood loss, she could not get an abortion. The fetus still had a heartbeat. Doctors told her Missouri law superseded their judgment, medical records show. She tried for days to get an out-of-state abortion, but many hospitals said they could not take her. In the end, an abortion helpline connected Farmer with a medical center in Granite City, Illinois. She drove more than 4 hours from home while in labor and had the procedure. News organizations reported on Farmer's story. She appeared in a political advertisement. Later, the Missouri Health Department started an investigation into whether the Joplin Hospital had violated federal law. The state has shared its early findings with the federal government. Farmer said the experience was deeply traumatic. She decided to take a permanent step to make sure nothing like this happens to her again. She got her tubes tied. The procedure prevents her from getting pregnant in the future. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
You just heard this week's Health and Lifestyle Report, presented by Ashley Thompson and Katie Weaver. Ashley joins me now to talk a bit more about the story. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Dan.
This week's report deals with a lot of complex issues and questions. You noted how, following the overturn of Roe v. Wade, doctors have to balance their medical judgment with abortion laws in their state. The report brings up the case of one patient in Missouri, Melissa Farmer. Her doctors said Missouri law superseded their medical opinion on whether she needed an abortion. Could you explain for our listeners what the word supersede means?
Sure. So the most common meaning of supersede is to take the place of something that is old, no longer useful, or no longer important. It is similar to replace. For example, many parts of the historic Route 66 have been superseded by large highways.
Can you talk more about the usage of the word in your report?
Of course. So, farmers' doctors claimed their medical judgment was superseded by Missouri's new abortion law, which bans the procedure except in the cases of serious medical emergencies. Basically, the doctors are saying that Missouri's strict abortion law overrides or replaces their own medical opinions. However, it's important to note that the Missouri hospital that Farmer went to is being investigated for denying her an emergency abortion.
Thanks for answering my questions, Ashley.
You're welcome. Anytime.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In the middle of the 1850s, the United States was again struggling with the issue of slavery. The dispute centered increasingly on Kansas, a territory in the middle of the country. In Kansas, white men were able to vote on whether they wanted slavery to be legal in the territory. Many Kansas settlers opposed slavery. Some of the settlers were Northern abolitionists. They believed that owning another person was immoral. Many farmers also opposed legalizing slavery. They did not want to compete with slave labor. But many people in the nearby state of Missouri wanted Kansas to permit slavery. Slavery was legal in Missouri, and many Missouri slave owners wanted to live next to a territory where slavery was legal. So when Kansas held elections, pro-slavery men from Missouri crossed the border and voted illegally. Yet their votes were accepted.
The result of the territorial elections is that you have a territorial legislature that is overwhelmingly pro-slavery. It will write a slave code for Kansas. It will say Kansas is a slave territory. Slavery is protected here.
Nicole Etchison is a historian. She says the newly elected Kansas legislature created strong laws to protect slavery in the territory. The laws said no Kansan could speak or write against slavery. And they said people who tried to help slaves escape could be put in jail or executed. The lawmakers also demanded that President Franklin Pierce dismiss the territory's governor, who opposed slavery. The president agreed. He appointed a pro-slavery governor instead. Anti-slavery settlers in Kansas grew angry. They felt they could not get fair treatment from the president or the new governor. They said pro-slavery groups cheated to control the elections. So the anti-slavery settlers took an extreme step. They formed their own government. Their political group was known as the Free State Party. Its members wrote their own constitution. They also chose their own governor. Historian Nicole Etchison says Free State members refused to recognize the bogus authority of the official Kansas legislature.
That is the argument that the Free State political movement will make. Not so much that slavery is an awful thing, although some of them make that argument, but that free white settlers in Kansas have had their political rights at the ballot box denied.
President Pierce said the actions of the Free State Party seemed revolutionary. He said that if party members attacked any government property or official, party leaders should be charged with treason. Pierce gave the pro-slavery governor of Kansas control of troops at two army bases in the territory. The situation threatened to turn violent at any time. In November 1855, a pro-slavery man killed a free state man in a dispute over land claims. To answer the attack, free state settlers threatened the killer and burned his house. At the same time, hundreds of pro-slavery men crossed the border from Missouri. They planned to burn the town of Lawrence, where many free state members lived. The pro-slavery governor and the free state governor agreed to hold an emergency meeting. They negotiated a settlement, and the men from Missouri went home. But the truce did not last long. In the weeks that followed, a pro-slavery sheriff attempted to arrest the leaders of the free state government, but failed. A few days later, the law enforcement official was shot. Around the same time, a pro-slavery grand jury found several free state leaders guilty of treason. The grand jury also said the town of Lawrence was supporting illegal newspapers and a hotel that stored weapons. Pro-slavery officials moved to take control of the town. The wounded sheriff urged private citizens to help. Once again, hundreds of men, including many from Missouri, gathered in Kansas. Once again, the target was Lawrence. This time, however, there was no truce. On May 21st, 1856, a group of pro-slavery men marched into the town. Historian David Potter describes the incident in his book, The Impending Crisis. He says the mob entered Lawrence with flags and flying banners as if it were a victorious army. Some men threw two newspaper printing presses into the river. Others freed as much alcohol as they could find. And Potter writes, the group turned five cannons on the Free State Hotel. The mob fired the cannons at the hotel and burned the house where the Free State governor lived. But no anti-slavery settlers were killed. The only person killed was a pro-slavery man. He died when part of the Free State Hotel fell on him. Anti-slavery newspapers called the attack the Sack of Lawrence. In other words, they suggested that pro-slavery raiders had completely destroyed the town. A settler named John Brown heard about the attack on Lawrence. Brown was from the eastern state of Connecticut, but he had recently moved to Kansas. He strongly opposed slavery. He also thought the free state government was too weak. So John Brown persuaded four of his sons, his son-in-law, and two other men to answer the sack of Lawrence. Brown believed that the battle against the forces of slavery must continue, and he believed that God had chosen him to lead it. Late at night, Brown and the other men went to a settlement near Pottawatomie Creek. They went to three homes and seized five pro-slavery men.
Took these men out of their beds, defenseless, unarmed, and hacked them to death with broadswords.
Historian Nicole Etchison explains that Brown's group seized the men, murdered them, and left their bodies next to the creek. The event became known as the Pottawatomie Massacre. The combination of the sack of Lawrence and the Pottawatomie Massacre frightened both pro- and anti-slavery forces. both sides believed they could be attacked at any time. They began collecting weapons to defend themselves. In the summer and autumn of 1856, the competing forces repeatedly threatened each other. They forced each other off land. They burned each other's houses. More people were killed. The territory became known as Bleeding Kansas. Nicole Etchison says the term Bleeding Kansas was evocative. In other words, it made people feel strongly.
The term is so evocative because it's a propaganda term.
Ms. Etchison says that many people, especially in the North, were against slavery in the territory. These individuals used the term Bleeding Kansas in their newspapers to gain support for their cause. The Kansas-Nebraska Act and the violence that followed also gave birth to a new political party. Its members called themselves Republicans. The Republican Party was an unusual combination of groups. It included former Democrats who were angry that their party had supported the Kansas-Nebraska Act. They believed the Democrats were allowing slavery to expand. The Republicans also included members of the old Whig Party. The Whig Party had lost badly in the elections of 1852 because its members could not agree on whether slavery should be legal. Anti-slavery Whigs found a new home in the Republican Party. The Republican Party of the 1850s also included voters who did not support immigrants, especially Irish Catholics. These nativist Republicans wanted to protect the rights of American Protestants. All Republicans were united, however, in their opposition to slavery in the Kansas and Nebraska territories. Some Republicans were abolitionists. They wanted to ban slavery everywhere in the United States. But the majority of Republicans had no interest in ending slave labor in the South. They simply did not want slavery to spread to other areas. Nicole Etchison says that white Southerners did not respond well to the new party. They believed that all Republicans were like John Brown, the anti-slavery settler who had murdered five pro-slavery men.
White Southerners do not see the distinction between a Republican Party that says, we don't like slavery, it's immoral, it shouldn't expand, and a John Brown who says, I don't like slavery, it's immoral, and it ought to be overturned by violence.
In 1854, some Republicans from the state of Illinois asked a politician named Abraham Lincoln to serve on their committee. Lincoln refused. He did not like slavery, but he still supported the Whig Party. 2 years later, in 1856, the Republicans nominated a presidential candidate for the first time. He was John C. Fremont. Fremont had explored the American West. He had been a senator from California. He was young and exciting. Republicans thought he was the right man to lead their young and exciting party. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
That's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.